Okay.
Yeah.
Logical positivist universal.
All right. Yeah, I was thinking actually today in the train. Very seldom one has a time like being on your own, not disturbed by distractions, and when trains work, to have a couple of hours or 3 hours continuous. I think how to start my presentations, and I wrote something which I think I should read because I can't say it better. Lyndon LaRouche has recently been saying that we have to think strategically. And I can add that our enemies do. But we have to do it not only because of that reason. At the same time, our enemies, they want to keep people bogged down in daily developments in the discrete manifold of sense perception, looking at events as they unfold every day. One day Iraq, next Libya, next Syria, next Ukraine. It's like a slideshow. At every slide they forget the previous ones and where and how they all started. It's like a musical piece. You hear the beginning, but then as you progress, if you are not a good listener or you are not educated in music, you forget how the whole thing started, and you lose sense of the whole idea of the musical piece, and you just listen to the pieces as they come, and you try to enjoy that part. This is what happens with, for example, the news coverage for people here in Europe, that every day there is a new situation, but where the process is that governs those, it's not in the news. You don't see them anymore. So instead, we should think about processes, not events. Processes and the causes in the continuous manifold, or what LaRouche or Platonic thinkers call the continuous manifold, where the real causes of things beyond sense perception happen. What we see with our senses, what we see in the news every day, this is what could be called the discrete manifold, where things pop up in front of your senses. But we have to look at the causes, at the continuous manifold that produce these discrete perceptions. We have to look at the intentions and ideas that govern those causes. That's even a higher level of just looking at the causes, because some people might interpret the invasion of Iraq not as a democratization process, which is for fools, but they say the reason is they want to take Iraq's oil. That's a stupid explanation. You have to look at a higher level than the simple explanation of the causes into the realm of ideas and intentions. The people who start, who like Tony Blair, what is the intention of Tony Blair in instigating the invasion of Iraq, where Bush and the Americans were already ready to swallow that bet? Blair's intention was, as he said in a Chicago speech, is that we have to move in a world beyond the Westphalian system, the peace of Westphalia system, where nations are sovereign and nations can decide and determine their internal affairs without interference from outside. He said that time is gone. We need a new era. But Tony Blair is not the real philosopher behind this. This is as old as the British Empire, but it has to be clothed in new, because it's not only the British who are acting upon the world, there are other groups, other individuals, other nations who are acting upon the world, and sometimes they manage to prevent a total takeover of the world by these forces. So they have to come up with news, like this Tony Blair's idea, that we have the responsibility to protect human rights in that country against atrocity. Okay, if we use the excuse of chemical weapons, or nuclear weapons in Iraq or in Iran as a lie, that justifies our intention because we want to protect the people. So yes, we lied, but the important thing for us was to take out Saddam Hussein because he was a dictator. And therefore, when they try to explain what's going on in Libya or Iraq or Ukraine, they also tend to try to simplify the thing for people. Like as we said earlier, that Putin is a gangster, Yanukovych is a thief, and so on and so forth. And that way they try to get the majority of the people to accept, at least passively, the policy which is leading us towards world war, actually. So it's like this idea of looking at the what are the ideas that govern different peoples or groups or even the oligarchy, what kind of ideas and intentions they have, not only today or this year or last year, but for actually a longer arc of history. That's what gives us the possibility both to understand what's going on around us, but also to be able to act upon it in an efficient way. So that's what I've been trying. We have a campaign in Sweden now, and in Sweden we have, maybe it's the same here, but in Sweden it's more extreme because there's an animosity towards Russia and historical animosity, which have affected people's view of Russia for historical reasons, but it completely does not justify the hysteria in Sweden against Putin and Russia. But in trying to how to tackle this thing with the population of Sweden and the media picture they present, there's no other way than trying to go the rough way or the tough way by trying to get people to understand the longer arc of history and to look at events from the standpoint of that these are parts of processes, a process which has started a long time ago before Hitler or Saddam Hussein or Putin or Yanukovych or whoever they think is a villain who should be taken out or a regime that has to be changed. And it's a tough way of trying to... Sorry, I'll just continue. it's a much harder way to look at the world than what we are used to, or people are used to today, because it's a much, much demanding effort than what people are used to, because you receive things passively, either information, news, or stuff, or people tell you to read this or that article. But rather than looking at the world not simply as a historian looking at history objectively, but as an individual who wants to change history. And when you look at these things subjectively, you look at history subjectively, every new thing you learn, it becomes part of your arsenal of being a person who wants to change history. It's not simply academic knowledge anymore. It's part of your means to be able to change people in trying to understand developments and trying to explain it to people, but also to act upon these developments. I think this is one of the best things I have acquired from being in this movement, because after, I thought I knew something about Iraq, my home country. But after I joined this organization, I realized everything I knew about Iraq was just almost useless. Because, first of all, I forgot most of it, which is not very recent history. And for the other reason, when I was studying Iraq's history, there was no purpose of studying that, other than passing the exam. Or for people who read history books, as we talked about, people who watch the news the whole time, they think they know something more than others because they can watch the news from many different angles. But people who study history books, they study it as like a hobby. So it does not become part of their mission in life. And that makes a big difference, like a huge qualitative difference if you read a history book as an activist or you read it as an academician. Because in the case of the activist, it becomes part of you. The academician is an objective thing. You look at it from distance. And therefore, you cannot use that knowledge to change reality today. But for an activist, to have knowledge of history, geography, physics, astronomy, all these things become part of your way of dealing with reality and changing reality. So it makes an enormous difference that whatever you learn is part of your mission. And you actually don't forget these things, at least not so easily. You have to review what you have studied and read quite frequently to replenish the arsenal or the tools you have in your hand, in your mind, to act upon reality. So it's like I talk from my standpoint of being in this movement and also looking at the things I am working on as part of this movement, looking at the Southwest Asia region, the history of that region, and not surprisingly, I had to come into direct confrontation with the British Empire. Because the British Empire determines almost everything in that place. Although the Americans have exerted influence increasingly, and they have physically affected the region very intensively with, you know, wars and so on, with bombing Iraq. But it's, you know, with all my due respect to American friends, like the American intelligence, they are not intelligent. You know, so-called CIA and the NSA and other. Although they have enormous means at their disposal, the only thing, or usually what they are good at, is killing people. But that does not make you intelligent. That's what is not an intelligence service is about. And therefore, the American intelligence and even political institutions, they are very, very dependent on the British in dealing with the region. And they are always taken, like, guided to the wrong place to do this killing. You know, the British, you know, how many people in the CIA know Arabic fluently or know the history of the Arab world or Southwest Asia? How many people spend 20, 30 years working and studying these societies or studying their history or their character or their religion? Very, very few people. The British do. They have spent 200 years there. And there are people who are so dedicated, they can die of disease in the jungles of Africa or in the desert in the Arab world. Not because they want to do a great service to humanity, but because they want to be part of the glory of the British Empire, that their name will be mentioned, you know, as part of, they made service to the British Empire. And I read about some of those people who actually working many, many years in Africa, in Sudan especially, and in the Great Lake region, in Central Asia, in Afghanistan, British intelligence officers who spend their life really living with the people there, suffering. Many of them get killed, many of them get sick, but they think this is a great service for the empire, and that's their mission in life. They do it very, very in a dedicated way. Well, that makes them different than us in our movement, that what we have a definition for what evil is and what goodness is. Because what they do defies natural law, which means to protect the sanctity of human life and to develop human life for individuals and societies. But their activity is destructive for other societies, and they believe it's constructive or in the service of their society, which is not true either. They are not helping the British people, or the people in England or Ireland. They suffered, you know, people in Ireland suffered as much as people in India or Afghanistan or Iraq under the British. Mm-hmm. So the idea of a great mission is different than what we talk about, what your great mission is. In any case, I got more involved in the fight against the British, and I got into a personal fight in some cases with certain British institutions or individuals, because I was trying to bring some of the ideas of the LaRouche movement into the Arab world, which is almost a forbidden thing to do. It's not only here in Europe, because in Europe you at least have a certain margin of freedom of expression where you can organize. You have an organization here in Denmark. You can go out and talk to people. You can print material. Or in America or in Sweden, you have a certain margin. You can move within that margin. But in the Arab world, it's very difficult to move. to do something like this. Therefore, you have to make pointed interventions on certain institutions and certain individuals and sometimes on the media to spread certain types of ideas. And in many cases, that was met with very, very terrible reactions from either British institutions or people who we consider as agents of British or American institutions. I can, in the discussion period, mention a couple of those cases which I was involved in, but also our organization is involved in. But in any case, my understanding of the British Empire and the mentality of the British Empire is not based on studying the Middle East. It emerged from my, as I said, being a member in this organization, had to study the history of the human race and how LaRouche and LaRouche's associates have been looking at the long arc of history of the fight between the oligarchical system and the humanist system, or what we can call the republican system, all the way back to Greece and old civilizations, and the whole idea of a Promethean individual and a Promethean society as opposed to the society of Zeus, the oligarch, where human beings are just simple tools of the powers or the powerful elites. And it's through that understanding of history, the human individual, and also the idea of what nation states are for, what the purpose of a nation state is, and what is the purpose of a human individual's life is, then you can go and study history, and then you crash immediately with the oligarchical system, which the British or certain American institutions represent. But then in practicing that, you get used to seeing what other people don't see when British institutions, the British Empire moves into a certain new phase or a new process. We detect it very quickly, or LaRouche detected it very quickly, while other people have to wait 2, 3, 4 years, and sometimes 10, 20 years, to discover that a certain process was going on that they did not notice until recently, until, well, the financial system crashed. But it was a process which was already in progress since the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the destruction of the modern Western or the American system, but also the productive societies in Europe and the United States. There was an intention to destroy that, and you can understand the intention behind it based also on your understanding or LaRouche's understanding on how the enemy thinks. And therefore you can detect certain things which other people don't detect it, or they think it's just a social phenomenon or an accident. And in that process you acquire a certain capability to read between the lines and see things which other people don't see, or they don't think it's important. I use this report from a British think tank, military think tank. It's called the Royal United Services Institute. It's a very, very old institution. It makes strategic analysis from a military strategic standpoint, and you can look at their website, the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI.org. You see their clients, they are very proud. Their clients, the people who read the analysis, are the Queen of England, the Prime Minister of England, the members of Parliament, and the important American institutions. They read their analysis, and they are obviously their sponsors too. So in the middle of this whole in April 2013, they issued this report. It's called A Return to East of Suez, UK Military Deployment to the Gulf. I can just simply read, because in the middle of the, after the so-called Arab Spring revolts, which came after the crash of the transatlantic financial economic system, they are part of the same process, because the destruction of the economies of North Africa, Tunisia, Egypt, specifically, was tied directly to the economies of the EU and the free trade agreements they had with the EU and other countries. So the collapse of these two nations, economies, was part of the financial crisis. But then when this process became militarized by the military attack on Libya, it was not simply a revolt by people against their dictator, but it was a direct military intervention by NATO in Libya, and then from Libya moved to Syria. The whole region seemed to be burning, and there is no solution, neither for Egypt, neither for Libya. Libya is becoming another Somalia, it's just that's on the Mediterranean. Egypt will be ultimately destroyed, the most important nation. Syria is being destroyed. Iraq is in a sectarian war fire. So what do the British want to do in that situation? Well, they have a new strategy. It's not a new strategy, but they want to pronounce it as a policy. And it's called a return to east of Suez, because the British, they occupied that region from Egypt eastward and southward. It's called east of Suez. And then they have to justify that policy. So in the foreword of this study, which I would like to read for you, I will read some sections of this just to give you an idea of how the reasoning goes. But also I warn you, this is not about the Gulf. It's not about the Gulf. It's not about oil, although the oil is important. The foreword of the report says, at a time of economic retrenchment and growing uncertainty within Europe, it may seem strange that the UK sees its future military security increasingly east of Suez. Such an emotive phrase suggests imperial ambitions at a time when UK armed forces are smaller than they have been for 200 years. But there are compelling reasons for the UK to take its Gulf relationships much more seriously. The military intends to build up a strong shadow presence around the Gulf, not an evident imperial-style footprint, but a smart presence with facilities, defense agreements, rotation of training, transit and jumping-off points for forces that aim to be more adaptable and agile as they face the post-Afghanistan years from 2014. Simply said that they want to use special forces, air force, and other intelligence military forces rather than large armed forces like in Afghanistan or in Iraq. Very specific points where they can intervene, but not everywhere. This may not yet be declared government policy, indeed. In Britain, it's not the government which decides the overall policy. The government's role, this is mine now, this is not the quote. In Britain, like in every parliamentary, the role of the British government is to control the people of the British Islands, keep them at a certain level, keeping politics simple and limited to the question of managing budgets and so on and so forth. But when it comes to major strategic issues, it's not the government which decides. There are other institutions that decide interventions on a global scale. So the City of London financial interests, it's the royal family, and other institutions related to the royal family, and so-called non-governmental organizations and institutions, the World Light Fund and so on, and this think tank, other think tanks like the Chatham House, these are where the reasoning for the empire takes place, but then it becomes government policy all of a sudden, where Tony Blair or Cameron comes suddenly with a speech or an intervention and says, now we have a new policy. But the policy is in shaping for a period. They prepare the ground for it, for the Prime Minister to present it in the suitable time. So they say, this may not be declared government policy, indeed. The government may prefer not to plunge into a public debate about it, but the UK appears to be approaching a decision point where a significant strategic reorientation of its defense and security towards the Gulf is both plausible and logical. I have to move forward. Then they say, of course, here it says, but how accurate it is, or how accurate is it, to say that the UK is returning to east of Suez. Indeed, did the UK ever really leave The facts would say that the UK did not. Rather, the UK presence in the Gulf endured, in particular, with the military posture reacting to the needs of the day, and the political relationships oscillating between different governments. So, basically, we did not leave the Gulf or the region. We are still there, but through other means, they control the financial institutions of Dubai, Saudi Arabia. They control the arms trade. They control the money laundry, drug money laundry from Afghanistan. All these are still run by British institutions and individuals. So it's not really leave, but this time it has to be in a different way. And then it continues, which comes to the crucial point I want to take, which I also mentioned to people in Japan, and I think people in China should think about it seriously. Is that there is a significantly more at stake in this renewed relationship than mere military posturing. By enhancing the UK's relationships with the states of the Southern Gulf, the UK is committing to the security and longevity of the Arab Gulf states, which are sheikhdoms, which display only limited elements of democratization, in parentheses, as understood in the West. So they're, okay, these are dictatorships, but this is the opinion of the people in the West. There is a different reality. And which have taken seemingly contradictory positions toward the Arab upheavals that spread across the Middle East since 2011, opposing the Shia revolt in Bahrain, but supporting the Islamic revolutions in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and Syria. The UK will also find itself very much on the fault line of searing sectarianism between the Sunni and Shia worlds of Islam that is increasingly defining the geopolitical landscape of the Gulf and Middle Eastern security, with Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and to a lesser extent Kuwait all contending with significant sectarian challenges to their internal security, and with Iran and Saudi Arabia engaged in what is so far a sectarian Cold War in which the temperature could quite easily rise. The unintended consequences, is a good, interesting, the unintended consequences and outcomes of UK strategic embrace of Arab Gulf states should not be underestimated. You say, unintended consequences. We did not mean to be part of this sectarian war supporting the Sunnis against the Shia, but this is part of what we will have to accept. Because we do support these Gulf states that happen to be, you know, sorry, they happen to be Sunni extremists, and we have to attack the Shia in Iran and Hezbollah in Syria. So we will have to take sides in this sectarian war on the side of Saudi Arabia and so on and so forth. But then comes this important thing which has very little to do with the Gulf other than being a place where they pump oil. And it says, lastly, this move is not just about securing loyal and wealthy allies in the Gulf. It's also a different iteration of the transatlantic special relationship. Much has been written about the Obama administration's Asia pivot. That means Obama administration declared their policy that they want to move emphasis, military strategic emphasis, from the Middle East, the Gulf, and Afghanistan to East Asia to contain China's ambitions. So the British are looking at the Americans and Asia, and then they want to play their role there by getting the United States to act in a specific way, you know, against China or other Asia or other rivals. And what means they have to intervene in that. So much has been written about the Obama administration's Asia pivot, the refocusing of U.S. efforts away from the Middle East and towards the Far East and Pacific Rim. The likelihood of the U.S. being drawn away from the Gulf to a significant degree as a result of this intending rebalancing remains a point of contention, how much the U.S. is going to pull out of the Gulf. Whether the U.S. wishes to or even can reduce its force commitment to a region that has had such prominence in its affairs over several decades should be questioned. Indeed, there is a line of thought that the Obama pivot may see the Gulf region become even more important to U.S. strategic planners, with one prominent commentator noting that, and they quote one commentator, and that commentator says that it's important for Obama administration to think how important the Gulf region is, but we can do the work for them, for the Americans, by controlling this area. And that point is, for geopolitical reasons, including China's increasing reliance upon Gulf energy exports, the American pivot towards Asia, and indeed sub-Sahara Africa for that matter, cannot be completed without the control of the Persian Gulf. And while the U.S. is happy to put the 9/11 wars behind it and wind down the extensive and traumatic military campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan, it cannot delink from the Persian Gulf. But irrespective of whether the U.S. remains in the Gulf or not, a clear strategic choice seems to have been made concerning where the country's strategic focus and attention will be in the future. That is the East. That the United States is going to focus on the East as an enemy, not as a potential friend. And that enemy in the East is reliant on the Gulf oil to a large extent. But that area, that Gulf, we will control for the American friends. Therefore, the United States should support this policy of the British in the Gulf. The UK's more obvious and effective engagement in the Southern Gulf, which will likely create opportunities for further engagement in the region, incorporating the Indian Ocean and the subcontinent, Indian subcontinent, could be seen as a new geopolitical expression of the U.S.-UK special relationship, perhaps designed to emphasize to Washington the value of an enduring, if changed, special relationship with the U.K., so that the U.K. will take the place of the United States in the Gulf, but we do it for your own sake, because we can control the oil going to China and the East. So it's not simply controlling the oil, but it's also how you can manipulate a conflict between the United States and China, which is going to be, as Obama has dictated, this is going to be the big challenge. China, that now Russia has came in the way, but Russia has to be destroyed to be able to destroy China, or vice versa. So Russia came first because of realities in Syria and Ukraine and so on and so forth, but that plan is to destroy Russia, is to destroy China. But it's this kind of thinking, you know, which is actually the kind of process which goes on in the minds and thinkers of so-called strategic planners for the British Empire and in the United Kingdom. Because they look at global issues. They don't look at that simple fact about the oil, about that. Because they cannot control the oil. They cannot sell the oil. The oil is produced and sold by the Arabs, but they can control the money. But also, who buys the oil? That's what is the big issue in the Gulf. 90% of the Gulf oil goes to Asia. You know, people think the United States went into Iraq to take the oil. That's a total lie, because there are almost no American companies working in Iraq. The biggest companies in Iraq are British Petroleum, Royal Dutch Shell, Chinese company, Lukoil from Russia, and some Malaysian and Argentinian other companies. But the Americans are not getting any oil from Iraq. They actually have to spend billions, hundreds of billions of dollars and get thousands of young men killed. They are getting nothing from Iraq. They are selling some weapons to Iraq now, but that's not big. But to say that, so the oil from Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Iran, it's all going to Asia. And this is what the British think. If we can control that area, then we can control the lives of people in China, Japan, South Korea, India, because they are very, very dependent on 17 million barrels of oil passing through the narrow Hormuz Strait every day. If anything happens there, it's good night in China, Japan, South Korea, and other parts, because they have, both for good and bad reasons, become very reliant on oil and gas exports from the Gulf. and in the Japanese, for example, it's their own fault. They're divesting from nuclear power to oil and gas after the Fukushima tsunami and nuclear incident. So it's this kind of what they consider strategic thinking, which is good about them. Now the problem is that this is in the public. This is a public debate. But very few people will come out today debating this issue or warning other nations, either in the region or in China and other places or in the United States, and look, something is being set up for you. You are being set up for something big. And these are the general lines. But for the British, they don't need to work in secret. They say this is a analysis, strategic analysis. But then at the same time they say, you know, the government is not ready, but this is in the works. And then one day we let the Prime Minister of Britain declare, because they are the ones who will do it. It's like in the times of the East India Company, the British government was auxiliary to the British East India Company. The British Army was part of the East India Company, was fighting wars for the East India Company. It's the same thing now. The Prime Minister of Britain and the Defense Minister, they are part of the BAE. Because the British Aerosystems company, it's the world's largest arms producer actually today. It surpassed even the American arms producers. They bought a huge part of the Swedish arms industry. Bofors, Hägglunds, armored vehicles, they're all part of BAE. So, but when the scandal of the BAE bribes to Prince Bandar came out, and it became very, very obvious that in order for the BAE to get these Tornado aircraft sold to Saudi Arabia, they had to bribe some people, including Prince Bandar and other princes. And the accounts came out and everything was exposed. So what do? Well, their employee, the Prime Minister of Britain, Tony Blair, shut down the investigation by an individual decision. He decided that this will be shut down. No further investigation. The BAE pays fines, 100-something million pounds as a fine for having done some terrible bad mistakes. That's it. No trials, nobody goes to prison, no information comes out, and even no information. And then the American president on the other side, he covers up for the BAE and the Prince Bandar by covering up the facts about what happened in 9/11. So the American president also becomes an employee of the empire to protect the empire from responsibility for crimes they committed. So now we have these 28 pages of the 9/11 commission, congressional commission, being completely classified under Bush and now even under Obama to protect who? The Saudis, who are the foot soldiers, and the BAE, who are the people in the background. So the British government are working for the BAE. They're not working for the British people. They're not working for any other people. They are some sort of employees. And then sometimes they have such drastic things as shutting down the investigation of the BAE or firing a whole bunch of people from the BBC in the period of preparation for the war in Iraq. I mean, the BBC is part of the Foreign Ministry Service, and a whole bunch of people from BBC were fired because they posed serious questions about the Iraqi weapons, so-called weapons of mass destruction, the death of Dr. David Kelly, the weapons inspector and the expert who had said that the Blair government had sexed up the information about the Iraqi weapons to start an invasion of Iraq. And the same BBC people, they brought Lyndon LaRouche on the BBC TV and radio channels to speak freely about the intentions of the Blair and Bush government. But they had to go so far, they fired a whole bunch of people from the BBC for doing that. So the British government is part of the empire, it's not the other way. And they serve in that. And it's the same thing for these so-called Gulf sheikhs and kings and so on. What the British have been good at is that they can cultivate what they call, in intelligence terms, called assets. People who are loyal, people who are trained by the British, And most kings and princes in the Gulf are trained and educated in British military academies, Sandhurst especially. They all of them have to go and study there. But Prince Bandar studied not in Sandhurst, he probably studied in the so-called Air Force Academy, British Air Force Academy, where he was being groomed as an agent of intelligence. It actually came out in the biography of Prince Bandar, which one of his former colleagues, a British colleague in the academy, had written. But Prince Bandar sanctioned the book, said, "Oh, that's great, no problem." So all these...
I'm proud of it.
I'm proud, you know. Like, as I said earlier, I mentioned to some people earlier that there's a famous letter from King Abdul Aziz Al Saud, I think from the 1930s, where he's the founder of the Saudi kingdom. He's the father of the current king. He had many wives and he had many children, and he got children at old age too. So now the kings who are 80, 90 years are the first sons of the Abdul Aziz Al Saud. So they have survived, but that's another health problem for the kingdom, which is posing serious strategic problems because all the crown princes are above 80. You know, the only place in the world where the crown prince is above 80. And so there's a succession crisis there. Anyway, so the King Abdul Aziz Al Saud at the time in the 30s and 40s, where the British were in the process of creating this quagmire in Palestine by establishing and backing a Jewish state, they were trying to organize support for that from Arab leaders. And one of the biggest supporters for the British plan was Abdul Aziz Al Saud. But instead of saying, you know, this sounds like a good idea, he did not even mention the idea. He said, whatever, it's a very silly letter, but it's signed by him. And he said, whatever my their excellencies or their majesty says, I will obey from now to the day I die. Yeah, and he said, anything they ask me to do, the British government or the monarchy, I obey. They are my benefactors. You know, they created our kingdom. They supported me since I was young, and they did everything for me. So all my existence is owed to them. So I'm going to be. And it's obviously his kids are also have to write that oath of allegiance to to the British throne.
Is that the old Lawrence of Arabia story?
Yeah, so Lawrence of Arabia was not significant. That was the problematic about these Hollywood things, which are usually British productions. What is more dangerous character was Sir John Filby. He was the companion of Abdul Aziz Al Saud for many, many years.
Okay.
He was a British intelligence officer. And he even converted to Islam. He wrote books about the history of the Arab world and Islam, and he lived there. He lived there 30, 40 years. He was the advisor of Abdul Aziz Al Saud. He's the father of the double agent Kim Philby.
Oh, okay.
The Soviet agent. Anyway, and he was the controller of Abdul Aziz. He would tell him everything he needed to do. I mean, when Abdul Aziz bin Saud expanded his sphere of influence in the Arab Peninsula, he had a very small region under his control. But since the 1890s to World War I and 1920s, he expanded enormously in the whole Arab Peninsula and kicked out the Sharifis, the great grandfather of the current king of Jordan. Now, the Jordanian kings, they were originally in what is today Saudi Arabia. The British moved them to Jordan and gave what is Saudi Arabia today to the Al Saud family.
The Hashemites,
yeah. And the Hashemites were made kings in Jordan, made the king in Iraq. We got to imported a king to us in Iraq, King Faisal, whom they had imposed on Syria, but then there was a revolt in Syria, so he had to move away. So the British gave him Iraq instead.
No.
In 1920. So all these kings and sheikhs and so on, they are complete creatures of the British Empire. I mean, the British had these... special treaties. I have a slide there from the 19th century, middle of the 19th century, where they signed protection treaties with all the important port cities in the Red Sea, the Arabian Sea, and the Gulf on the way to India, that they would not sign any military or any economic agreement with any other power than Britain. And they will, in return, get money, weapons, and other kind of support from the British Empire if they decline any other agreements with other powers. So they become loyal servants to the British.
When was this again?
In the from the 1850s to 1880, they were successively signing all kinds of agreements with the sheikhs. Like this famous agreement with Kuwait, which the Iraqis said, you know, that was the reason for the invasion, because Kuwait was part of Iraq. But in 1880, the British signed a special agreement with the Sheikh al-Subah that this is a separate protectorate of the British, which is separate from the Ottoman Empire, which was occupying Iraq. Kuwait was, under the Ottoman Empire, was part of Basra, which is an Iraqi province. But after signing the treaty with Britain, Kuwait became a separate entity.
Protected by
the British. Mm-hmm. And the Ottomans, they remained in Iraq, but they were in a fight with the British. So they had all these protection agreements, and they continue until today. Because all these Gulf countries, without American military protection, you know, they will not survive. You know, they'll either be infighting, or they will be, the people will revolt against them. But like, it's funny that there's all this infighting between the Gulf states, like in the 1920s and 30s, the British had basically occupied all these countries after World War II, like the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain. But these tribes, who were tribes, they were not nations, they had border disputes on oases here and there. So there's a famous dispute between Kuwait and Saudi Arabia over a border region. So the British advised them to negotiate the thing so they don't fight. So on the Saudi side, there was a British officer negotiating, and on the Kuwaiti side, another British officer negotiating. So they negotiated the border dispute, and they came out with a solution by making that area a neutral area.
Yeah.
But both sides were British officers negotiating, one for the Saudis, one for the Kuwaitis. The same thing happened in the so-called Okair oasis between the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. There was also a dispute. Also settled by the British. So, what is absurd is that it continues until today. It's like the case of Qatar, for example. I mean, people were so fascinated by Al Jazeera channel, the first Arab channel which would criticize the Arab leaders and the regimes and everything. But they would criticize everyone except for Qatar. They would attack, and that was new in the Arab world, to attack an Arab president or king. That was completely new, and that's why they could attract people to their channel. And it was a satellite channel. You can pick it up anywhere in the world. So it's not a cable channel where the authorities can stop it. So they were attacking Saudi Arabia, they were attacking Egypt. And then I saw this a big phenomenon, so I said, let me look at this thing. It was 96, 97. And I looked at it, and I immediately discovered that this was the BBC. That Al Jazeera is the BBC Arabic service moved from London to Qatar after a coup, a palace coup, which the Sheikh Hamad made against his father, who was a friend of Saudi Arabia. When the father was for medical treatment in Switzerland, he made a coup with the help of some tribes in Qatar against his own father in 1995. And he made himself the sheikh or the ruler of Qatar. Now the father went to Saudi Arabia and said, you have to help me to get back my throne. So the Saudis and Egyptians arranged a counter coup, a military counter coup in Qatar, which failed. Now what happened is that before the counter coup, the British queen was the first to recognize the new king, the new ruler, as a legitimate ruler. So Britain is not going to help in bringing back the father. And obviously they helped prevent the coup. But I have no information about that. But it's a hypothesis that they were instrumental to prevent the coup, because only a major power could have stopped both Saudi Arabia and Egypt from carrying a counter coup. So anyway, but a few months after that, a big fight broke out between the British, the BBC, and the Saudis. Because at the time, Osama bin Laden, before he became the great Al-Qaeda leader, he was starting a movement in Saudi Arabia against the Al-Saud family, because he wanted to return from Afghanistan to establish a new system, or that the Al-Saud family should be reformed according to his religious ideas. And they should change many of these, that the family controls the country, blah, blah, blah. There's an old dispute between the clergy, the Wahhabi clergy, and the Al-Saud. They're not always friends. It's a marriage of convenience, which the British orchestrated to give the Al-Saud family religious leverage in one of the most important countries of Islam, where the Mecca and Medina are, where millions of people go to pilgrimage every year. So they had to make this marriage of convenience, but they didn't like each other because the Al-Saud family members, they're corrupt, you know, simply made pigs, most of them. They don't respect religion, you know, they don't respect Islam, you know, they practice prostitution, they take drugs and alcohol and so on.
Go for gambling towards
gambling and wasting money on all kinds of dirty things. So, yeah. But they have to be protected by a religious entity to justify their acts.
But this is also like the classical, this divide and conquer, divide and rule from the Roman Empire and from the British Empire.
Yeah.
Because at the same time as you support somebody to rule a country, you always have also, you support somebody to dispose them.
Yes.
So they will have to do as you say, because else they will be disposed.
Yeah, mm. This is exactly what happened with Al Jazeera. I put it in an article in EIR, Executive Intelligence Service, called Al Jazeera Demystified, where it explained how the British blackmailed the Al Saud family by using bin Laden and his people. And I took Al Jazeera case because the BBC Arabic became involved in destabilizing the Saudi royal family, because they brought bin Laden's assistants, who used to live in London, and they had an office in London, Muhammad al-Mas'ari and Saad al-Faqih. They had an office of it's called the Advised Committee, giving advice to the Saudi people, so to speak. They were in exile because they were imprisoned for a while, and then when they released from prison, they fled to Britain. But they and one other guy, Khalid al-Fawaz, who was a secretary of bin Laden, they established this organization and rented a house in London and started printing bin Laden's communiques and send it to the press. I mean, we as a press agency used to get these press releases. I have I compiled them into a book. All of them with the signature of bin Laden on them from the office in London. So I have it, I can send you copies. So you can see bin Laden's signature on them. But it's all based in London, and bin Laden himself used to be in London every now and then. But what happened after the coup in Bahrain is that the BBC started bringing...
In Qatar.
The BBC started playing this pressure game on the Saudis. Because in Saudi Arabia you also had a succession problem, and some members of the royal family were intending to go in a bit different direction, including King Abdullah of today, to have more cooperation with the Arab countries, with Syria, with Egypt, with Iraq, and so on. And even he went along an idea to have a new peace process with Israel, a proposal for a peace with Israel. So I think the British didn't like that so much. So in order to guarantee that the Saudis remain loyal to the geopolitical game, they had to use this pressure presented by bin Laden, but also there was a large part of the clergy, the Wahhabi clergy in Saudi Arabia, who sided with bin Laden against the Al-Saud family. They had a There's a long list in these communiques of the clergymen in Saudi Arabia who signed Bin Laden's statement, a call for reform of Saudi Arabia.
Hmm.
And I have it too. And all of the people on the list were put in prison, but just for a short time, because they cannot afford to have all of them against them, against the al-Saud. They're put in prison in Saudi Arabia. But two or three, they fled to Britain, and they established this office financed by Bin Laden and run by his secretary, Khalid al-Fawaz. Khalid al-Fawaz was imprisoned later by the British, but they refused to deliver him to the United States after 9/11. Like many others who the Americans won't deliver, but the British are refusing. Anyway, but what happens is that the BBC Arabic service TV channel started bringing these two opposition guys to speak to the whole Arab world about the weaknesses of the al-Saud family, the atrocities, the oppression of the people in Saudi Arabia, on BBC. So the Saudis turned to be the ones who provide the satellite service.
It's called the British, not the Saudis.
No, the Saudis.
Okay.
They provide, because the British not only want you to commit suicide, they want you to pay for it too. So the Saudis paid for the BBC service being aired on satellite. And they paid for the offices and the computers and the salaries of the people in the BBC Arabic. This was not my information. This was written later by the head of the Arabic, British Arabic service. British guy, I forgot his name. I have it in my article. I quote him first in my article about the Al Jazeera. But the Saudis then suddenly said, okay, we pay the satellite service. We pay for the offices of the BBC, but then they bring those guys who want to overthrow us. So they shut down the satellite service and they took the computers from the BBC, the Saudis. They shut it down completely. It disappeared from the air. So, lo and behold, the BBC Arabic staff appears where in Qatar under the name of Al Jazeera. The same people, the same staff, with new computers, new and a new satellite service. Now they start throwing shit at Saudi Arabia and Egypt. And the poor Arab peoples watching the TV, they thought, oh, this is a great democratic station. Who can afford to criticize the Saudi family? Who can afford in our world to criticize Hosni Mubarak, you know? And then they, but all that was to attract the Arab viewers and make Al Jazeera the central information
outlet
for everyone, including all the tapes of Bin Laden, which came later after 9/11, exclusively acquired by Al Jazeera. Yeah,
courtesy.
All the tapes.
Courtesy of British intelligence.
Yeah. And they used to cooperate Al Jazeera for a time with a known publicist in London, Abdul Bari Atwan. He's always on BBC as an analyst. He was the head editor-in-chief of Al-Quds Al-Arabi, another. He's a Palestinian, so his brand is he defends the Palestinian rights, and that way became popular. But he became integral in the Al Jazeera operation, but he also became part of the process of sending people to interview Bin Laden in Afghanistan. He would help journalists meet Bin Laden in Afghanistan after the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya in 1998, which was the first big Al-Qaeda operation. Before that, Al-Qaeda was not known. Al-Qaeda made a declaration, Bin Laden and Zawahiri made an open declaration to fight the Americans and the Zionists, was called. But that, nobody paid attention to that. It was like another communique coming from a crazy group, where they declared war on the United States and the Zionist regime in Israel in 97 from Afghanistan. But then the first major operation was the bombing of the embassy, American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. And after that, Bin Laden became the big name for that. So the BBC and their people, they're the only ones who could get to Bin Laden in Afghanistan and interview him or get his tapes and broadcast them on their channels. Now, the American administration and intelligence services' role is to cover up for the British in these cases. Yeah? I mean, there are honest people in the American intelligence and otherwise, but they are shut down, you know, or kept shut up. They are told to shut up if they come up with some interesting information which defies the interest of the British Empire. It's like the whole, not only the 9/11
28
pages were blacked out, even the attack on the American embassies was blacked out. I mean, I read the whole trial process of the defendants of the case against the people who were arrested, some of them arrested in Kenya and in Tanzania, and brought to an American court in the United States in 1999-2000. It was like many months long trial. They arrested some people who were involved in the attack on the embassies. So I read that was the beginning of internet was becoming available. So there was a special website, a spooky website. They were publishing government documents that are available, but they even published the proceedings of the trial. Everything which is being said in the trial, they published them. So I was reading them every week, every month when they come out. So I read the whole trial. And the whole time I was saying, what is the, what do you call it, the, not the defense, the
prosecutor.
When is the prosecutor asking the question? You know, when is they going to ask the question? And the question I was waiting to be asked is, who's this guy who was working in the United States as a security advisor, but before that he was working, actually he voluntarily went to the, he's an Egyptian, his name is, the nickname is Abu Muhammad al-Amriki, Abu Muhammad the American, they nicknamed him in Al-Qaeda. He was an Egyptian military officer, he went voluntarily to the United States Embassy and said, I can work for the CIA, like this. And it was a completely crazy idea to go to the American Embassy in Cairo and say, I want to work for the CIA. And they say, oh, nobody paid attention to him. After a while, he appears in the United States, marries an American woman, gets a green card, and then involved in Fort Bragg anti-terrorist training, military training program, Delta Force and so on. And then after that, after a while, he tells his officers, you know, I'm going to go to Afghanistan. You know, just like this. So this guy was involved in training the security staff of Bin Laden when Bin Laden was in Sudan in 94-95 period. But he was also involved in teaching the team that blew the American embassies in Tanzania and Kenya how to make a surveillance of the site and choose where to place the bombs, the car bombs, and how to shape the car bombs, the explosives on the car bombs, to cause the greatest damage to the embassy buildings. So he trained the team. He was also involved in other things, being a bodyguard for Bin Laden and so on. He trained the bodyguards. But he was involved also in importing certain types of weapons and satellite communication devices for Bin Laden from Britain and the United States. Now, this guy was back in the United States. He was arrested by the FBI, obviously. And he was put on the trial. In the first day, he pleaded guilty, but offered to cooperate with the FBI, with the prosecutor, in return for protection. You know, like, he would be like considered as a witness, as an FBI witness under protection. So from the first day, they removed him completely from the trial.
It's not questioned further.
Nobody questions him. Nobody knows where he is. The defense cannot interview him. You know, he was not even a witness. He was like he became a source for the FBI. So he was removed to an undisclosed place, and he completely disappeared from the trial. So what they had is like a couple of guys from Tanzania and Kenya who were lured by Bin Laden's people to drive the car and place it there. And that's it. But there was a whole network of diamond smuggling, money laundering, in Africa, which the FBI was tracking. They even went into the offices of the Bin Laden company in Kenya and confiscated computers months before the attack on the embassies. Because Bin Laden's people were involved also in diamond smuggling from Africa and so on. But the FBI had tracked those people for months before the attack. They even knew about this guy who was training the people. And then suddenly he's protected by the FBI, nobody can question him. So the whole trial became completely meaningless. So in June 2001, I wrote an article that said, the FBI knew or should have known. Based on the looking at the trial, said either the FBI knew that this was going on and they let it happen and they covered it up, and that people should be questioned, put on trial or fired. If I were an American official, I would demand that. Or they completely missed everything and they should be fired for that because they're incompetent. But why nothing happened? And I say that was June 2001, you know, just a few months before. But our colleagues had even investigated the attack on the World Trade Center in the United States in 1993 with the Sheikh.
And the FBI was smack in the middle of it.
The FBI sent the guy who put the bomb there. And they say, oh, we made a mistake, you know? So, I mean, this whole establishment, this rotten establishment in the United States, which is covering up for whom? They're not covering up for some American interest, they're covering up for the British. Because the United States is getting nothing.
Yeah.
As a gift, they got 9-11 2001 from the British and the Saudis.
But the thing is also ironic that you can then, I mean, the best broadcasting propaganda that Al-Qaeda can get, they get through the CNN, or, you know, they put them up there and they talk, and if you have some, like in America, who are sympathetic with their causes, you know, they can go out and do something in the local, you know, so you have suddenly Al-Qaeda outlets, you know, all over the world.
But it's not true that the Americans got nothing. The Saudis and the British financed Bush and Cheney to be in power for 8 years, and then they financed Barack Obama to take over, courtesy of the British Empire.
So what defines an intelligence service? You know? I mean, if you are a Danish or American or Iraqi intelligence service, what defines what you are? What kind of intelligence you need? It's not just some simple facts. I mean, the facts are available.
Right.
But you need to learn how to make a hypothesis about the causes behind these facts. Mm. What are the forces that create these facts? And what is the mental, intellectual, scientific method of those people who are creating these? And therefore, we have to study the British Empire, the so-called philosophers like Bertrand Russell, LaRouche emphasizes a lot. You know, you got to know who Russell is. You got to know who Malthus is, the Malthusian ideology, which is the basis for today's green ideology. So the British East India Company policy. But even before that, this is an old oligarchical method of thinking, which Venice represented, which the Roman Empire represented, you know, the Persian Empire represented, and so on and so forth. So they have to copy this ideology because they are not so creative. But unfortunately, it works certain periods of time. And sometimes with the humanist tendency wins by creating a renaissance and bringing the human race to a higher level before they also get crushed, and then the oligarchical forces come forward and take over. But it's generally, as I think Plato says, you know, people and nations are not destroyed by evil often, but by stupidity. And therefore, now we have the nations of Europe and in the United States, they will be destroyed by their own stupidity rather than by the evil of others, because they cannot figure out what's going on around them. They are fighting the wrong enemies. The United States have been fighting wrong enemies for a long time, since Kennedy was killed.
Unless you have the traitor faction inside who wants to say, okay, we'll benefit from being part of, you know, destroying the That's their thinking.
But
yes.
there's also, like you say, you have to know this, but you also then have to know who are you. Because if you're an intelligence officer, if you're an intelligence service, you have to know what you're fighting for.
Yeah, who are you working for?
Exactly. What? Who are you working for, and what are you working for?
What mission are you on?
What is the higher mission
yes.
you're on? And if you don't know that,
intelligence becomes killing people, which turn out to be innocent people most of the time.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, for instance, just like with that in the US, you have people like Edgar Allan Poe, or Morse, or James Fenimore Cooper. You know, you had intellectuals who were at the same time the core of the US secret intelligence service trying to promote the real purpose of the United States. And what do you have now? You have John Brennan as CIA chief.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you can become an analyst without being a statesman and
but,
a philosopher.
But if
it's
you
kind of ridiculous, because I mean, to be an intelligence officer in the US, they must be crazy, right? I mean, this whole thing with Syria, right? The intelligence community has they know everything. If there was a president that wants to shut down the war on terror, they could do it tomorrow.
Mm.
It'd be over. It's ridiculous. So that's what you're saying about the intention. What are you fighting for? Like, for them, it must be meaningless, and that's why you have people like Edward Snowden or Manning. That then, for them, it's suddenly they realize, what the hell am I doing? It's completely, totally meaningless, right? All this work is for nothing. It's totally against everything I thought I was. I mean, in Snowden's case is explicit, right? It's
yeah.
totally against the Constitution. Everything I thought I loved, I was fighting for. Why I joined.
Actually,
and that's the one
whole,
place. Huh?
The whole case with Edward Snowden is kind of something doesn't feel right, something doesn't seem right about it. Especially all the information he collected. Where is it? We've been told that he had 16,000 pages or 1.6 million pages. How the hell did he collect all this information in such a short time span? Why did he give
anything?
All the information to Glenn Greenspan?
Greenwald,
yeah, who's working with Pierre Omidyar right now, who's one of the guys who's behind the Ukrainian crisis. Yeah, something just doesn't feel right about it.
I think depends on what you mean.
I don't think he's an
angel. Because see, I mean, the only thing you can say, I mean, the question, what you can question is, was he alone?
Mm.
Was there more like him helping to collect intelligence? But else, see, the point is, one of the, what you really have to understand in terms of these apparatuses, I mean, here you have a private, he being employed by a private contractor. And by being that, then he's suddenly in a position where he can get absolute access to everything. He can get access to things they won't even show the president, almost.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because he's a private contractor working for this monster. So, and that's the key thing, of access, of having all of these things. Then comes a point where you say, I'm going to make this decision of my life. I'm going to expose this. And from that day on, it becomes a question of collecting what you know will be crucial evidence to expose this monster.
Yeah.
And that's hard work. You have to be skilled how to do it. You have to have access, which he had. But in terms of why he's doing it, I think that's pretty straightforward. I mean, that's not strange. And you have some of the others. I mean, I think who are the ones that are coming out to resist this? I mean, we have the other case of some of the people that has been collaborating with us and been going out also on the impeachment of Obama from the military, from the intelligence services,
yeah.
like this former assistant to Colin Powell, what is his name? Wilkinson, right? Who simply, I mean, when you hear these people stand there and speak, they'll say, you know, they'll say, look at this monster the United States has become. We have become the antithesis to what we were created to be. I will not allow this to happen. I'm going to fight this. What the other side is also doing, very consciously, what the British have been doing, is with this whole conspiracy world, which they are spending a lot of money on manipulating and creating and running and things. Because the whole idea is to engage people in the idea that everything else can only be a mirror image of the British way of life. That if somebody is opposing to this, then it's just because they have their own similar motives and they have them fighting against this. What they do not, cannot accept, will not accept, and will fight to the death, is what, for instance, we represent, and therefore we know it exists. People who are fighting on the basis of totally different principles.
But that
exists. And we know it exists because we have it. But you also then have other people there who are grabbed by this. And then, of course, becomes, you know, entities that other people can use to annoy the British and the Americans. Like, why is Snowden in Russia right now? Because Russia right now is a key stronghold going against this empire taking over the world, and therefore they... you know, will allow him to be there for this operation to run.
But what Snowden hasn't revealed anything new. We have had a lot of whistleblowers throughout the time. People like Russell Tice and...
Yes, he has, because, see, that's the key thing. I mean, in a certain sense, it's not new. Everybody knew this is how it had to be.
But
there's a huge difference between having that as a theory, and then actually being able to put documentation.
Because they can deny it. Like they.
Because then they can't deny it.
They can listen to Angela Merkel, what she's talking about with her assistant. You know, they can deny it, but when it comes out, they cannot deny it.
But we have had plenty of whistleblowers throughout the time who's told this. Even in the media, there was this FBI agent that was being interviewed in relation to the Obama administration spying on some journalists, and he told, "Yeah, we collect everything."
But
the journalist was like, "What? Are you for real? Yeah, I'm for real."
But the point is, you can have all of that, and it has no effect. So it's not about facts. This is, in a certain sense, a war for the minds of the people. You have to, to give you an example, if Edward Snowden's, all of what he had, if they had taken that and published it all at once, you know, making like a media gallery, everybody could come in, then everybody would come in and they would look and they would be appalled and blah, and they would go 3 weeks and then that's the end of this story because we've seen there and it's bad and let's move on. The whole thing is, this is a design campaign, like Chinese water torture. Drip, 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 drip. And every time people say, well, that was bad, and now we will get on with our lives, 1-2 weeks later comes the next revelation.
Yeah.
So it's you have to see this is a design in a certain sense.
But there's also one thing which I mentioned earlier, is that what the intention. Because I think one thing which distinguishes Snowden from Assange, for example, Assange is a complete anarchist. Snowden, in one of his speeches which he made public, is that defended the American Constitution and the principles upon which the United States was based, and that being betrayed by the current administration, by previous administrations. So his intention that he's acting as a citizen, not simply as somebody who wants to reveal things, because that's exactly what we are fighting for.
Yeah.
Is to preserve the United States as a sovereign nation state with what we call the American system, and also the right of other nations, exactly like the United States, to be sovereign and independent nation. That also means that every individual in society is sovereign, exactly as a nation, and that their freedom and integrity should be protected. And I think that what, for me, showed me that Snowden is a different type of character, you know, than these other whistleblowers who just say it's through information that we can free the world. It's not information that will free the world. It's an idea, a mission, an intention, what you want to do in this world, which will free the world.
It's also a question of the level you operate on. See, one thing is that you, by chance, as you go through life, you discover something that is bad, something that is rotten. And you decide, I have to do something with this. Mm-hmm. And as you try to do something to it, you find out that this is, people don't like you speaking about this, and you then have a choice. Do I keep pursuing this at risk, to risk my life, my career, everything, or do I shut up like most people do? And then it is courageous that they stand up and they do this. But you have to understand the Snowden phenomenon is totally different. Because this is not that. This is him with whatever backing he has had in terms of people, I don't know. But this is on a much, much higher level. Because this is, from the beginning, you look at the future, you look, it's not 1 month, it's not 1 year, it's like a long-term project. How are we going to expose and dismantle this monster? And you can't do that if you don't win the minds of people to take the fight for this. Mm. So it's simply on a much, I mean, you can say in terms of execution of what he is doing. I mean, it's on a much, much higher level. It's much more skilled. And then, of course, some people would argue, well, one person alone cannot do that. That, I don't know, but it's once you begin, of course, you get natural allies. But it's
actually I don't see it as like you're talking about
I think torture.
I actually see it more as a conditioning process. People get used to being watched
on, spied on
every day. Mm-hmm. It's just it's the new normal. It's like you know the analogy with the frogs but if you put some frogs in some boiling water, they will jump out. But if you slowly turn up the heat, they'll keep sitting until they die.
But actually, it's not. See, it looks like that because we sit in Denmark. And Denmark is somehow I don't know how people simply swallow everything. I mean, I'm amazed. But this is not what's going on in Germany. In Germany right now, the nation, a majority of the Germans says, you cannot trust the Russians. And a majority of the Germans says, you cannot trust the Americans. And we should not be allied to the Americans against the Russians. We should not be allied to the Russians against the Americans. We should be in the middle and we should know that we can't really trust any of them. So we have to act as a sovereign nation based on other principles. This would not have been possible without Edward Snowden. You cannot imagine how big an impact that has been having in Germany. Because, in a certain sense, you can say it's this thing about naive. As long as you can pretend not, you don't know. You know, I love my husband, you know, he's there for me, and so on and so on. So, well, don't you wonder why he's almost out three nights every week, you know, and he comes home smelling of perfume, and there's all of these, you know, things being bought on his credit card, you know. What is going on here? And that's one thing, you know, but you can pretend not to know these things. You can lull yourself into a fantasy world. But then if you again and again is presented with hard facts, you have to respond to it. In Germany, this has had a huge effect. other places you can say it's a breakup of a naive illusion about how the world functions, but it has a tremendous effect.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a little bit delayed because there's such a huge shock effect. It takes a little time before people really assimilate. And maybe this is the case in Denmark. Somehow people simply
retarded.
I don't know. But don't think it does not have an effect. And yes, you can say, is there not the danger if people know how the world is run that they get cynical? Sure, there's that danger. But at least, this is what Shakespeare does. This is, you can say, what is Shakespeare up to? Why does he write Othello? Why does he have a Iago? Does he want to teach people how to be evil? is this a school in how to trick people? Well, you can use it for that. And I'm sure, many British intelligence officers, they have big smiles when they see what's going on, and they say, that was very cunningly done. Yeah. I couldn't have done it better myself.
More tomorrow.
But that's not the point, though. It gives you an insight. Then how you use the insight, that depends, of course, on you.
In Sweden, it's even worse, because in Sweden, you say, well, let them spy, I am not doing anything dangerous. Well, it's ironical, but it's true.
Yeah.
Swedish people have nothing to fear, because they're doing nothing in terms of politics, or because they don't talk politics on the phone, or to their friends, or to their kids. Nobody talks politics in a social context. They maybe read the newspaper, and say, oh, how terrible, how bad, But then they say, oh, let them spy. I have nothing to fear. I'm clean, It's like, but the risk of what you are saying is that I hope it's not what you're trying to conclude is that you cannot do anything about these things.
No.
or all these things that happen. If somebody comes with a breaking the rules, and then they are suddenly accused of being part of the conspiracy, this would paralyze people. Because nobody would dare to do anything good, or even attempt to do anything good, because they might be accused of being part of another type of conspiracy, but it's part of the big conspiracy. So we don't go around and thinking that everybody, we are not paranoid.
No.
Not everybody is an agent, not everybody
is
controlled.
This is what has been done to us as an organization from every angle. They go out and they say, but the LaRouche people is anti-Semite. If they go to the Arabic people, then they'll say, the LaRouche people.
Should just turn off this. I'm going to give you an example.
Should we turn it off?
Turn it off.
No, but it's interesting.
No, about this anti-Semitic thing, because.
Oh, wait a minute.
Let me do it.